Senate Resources Committee will first come to order. First order of business, we did move out in the markup the other day, sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 36. I have the sign sheet here, and there's a letter of intent that we had discussed that's in your packet. Do I have a motion on the letter of intent? This will be good.
Madam Chair, I move the letter of intent.
Is there objection? And without objection, so be it. During the, is Keith?
Madam Chairman, could I ask just one question?
Certainly.
Oh, all right. You've taken care of that. That's fine.
It is the intent with this bill, as it goes to finance, that we do not send it on as a amended bill. They will amend and finance in order for time, and two members of our committee are on that, so that should take care of it.
Madam Chairman.
Someone call a license to, yes.
Have you ordered a substitute? Is that, are you going to do that right now?
You mean?
Just to save time on this, on the bill.
Shall I have it as a finance committee amendment?
Yeah, why don't you just go ahead and do that? If your staff could, and that would just have it prepared as a finance
committee substitute. Thank you, Senator Sturdzielewski. Did someone call?
Yes.
Okay. A license, please. On the next order of business, sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 162.
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I've just been informed that the gentleman from Sears has just.
Keith's gotten it?
Yes.
Good.
What's he doing? Hanging his hat up?
All right. If you remember in our markup session, it was mentioned that Keith Campbell would be here today, and we, in order to take advantage of his testimony, we decided to hold action on SB 162 until after that time. So if we can get Keith, hello. Keith, you're on. My apologies to Department of Fish and Game. We'll try not to take too much of your time.
I'll be over there.
Mr. Campbell, in discussion and going through Senate Bill 162, the question arose as to location of and suitability of various locations concerning dock facilities. And we thought you might be able to shed some light upon that area of it, since you are from Seward, which is one of the areas under consideration.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I would like to address my comments to the memorandum of February 11, 1981 of the Alaska Agricultural Action Council Transportation Committee. Its conclusion was in the second paragraph, and I'll quote, "The grain port terminal should be constructed at the port of Anchorage, provided that the cost site preparation and facility construction not exceed $2 million over similar costs at the Port of Seward. This potential cost differential should be estimated as soon as possible by a competent engineering and design firm." The City of Seward takes exceptions to this particular conclusion in light of the $2 million discrepancy or weighting of the factors in favor of Anchorage for several reasons. Give me a moment to review my notes that I made on the airplane.
certain, I know, I apologize to you for this being such a hurried thing, but we do appreciate your time.
The memorandum goes on to state for and against points for both parties. Are you conversant, or is the committee conversant with this particular memorandum?
I don't know about the rest of the committee. I am fairly well. No.
All right. Well, then maybe I ought to read as I go, point by point. Points for and against the point of Anchorage. The Anchorage is the closest point to the present and future major production areas of the state, Delta Junction, Enana, and Point McKenzie. Number two, a larger service area exists. Number three, the conditions surrounding the road and rail offers, rail route offers a better competitive scenario. Number four, power at present is the least expensive in Alaska. Number five, Anchorage has a greater possibility of serving as a distribution point for the agricultural industry in South Central. Number six, a complete port management system is in place. And now the points against siting this particular facility in Anchorage. There may be an access problem to the dock due to icing situation and tidal variations. That is an obvious against. Location of grain terminal in a major population center may cause environmental concerns. Number three, depending on site location, construction costs in Anchorage may exceed those in Seward. The Port of Anchorage offers limited possibilities for expansion. Now, points for and against the Port of Seward. The Port of Seward would appear to be a better port facility for major shipping. Seward is a low population density, which may not raise the environmental concerns. The Port of Seward has a good area for expansion. The construction costs may be lower in Seward specifically for site preparation and due to a location in closer proximity to the water. Against, there is a $2 a ton minimum cost differential favoring the Anchorage over Seward. There's a longer turnaround time for rail cars in Seward. The road conditions and distance to Seward are not favorable for competition between transportation modes. There is no tugboat available in Seward. Seward offers a smaller service area. There's a greater possibility of road and rail closure due to avalanche into Seward than there is in Anchorage. Now I'd like to go through these particular points and with Seward's position, if I might, in relation to them. The presentation was made that this memorandum comes out of between on a 2-day notice to the people in Seward, at least, to come up and discuss the siting possibilities with the Transportation Committee. We weren't privy to these kinds of questions that I just went over with, and our particular people did not know that it was going to be a full-blown proposal. However, Port of Anchorage was there addressing all of these points with charts, flip charts, data, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as if the questions had been asked of them previously. Our people had absolutely no chance to rebut. That is one of the major reasons I'm here today. But I'll go on to specific rebuttals of the points against of the strengths and weaknesses of the two ports. Anchorage is closest to these areas. That's true. Number two, a larger service area exists. This is a very small value when you're considering the tonnages that are being looked at of shipping over the next 10 years, in quote, their short term. The service area absolutely has nothing to do with this because it takes a dock, a deep water dock. It takes a few men to man the facilities at those particular times of year that you're shipping the grain. Number three, conditions surrounding the road and rail routes offer a better competitive scenario. That may or may not be true. The shipment will be by rail. This is not a multimodal system at this point in time for agricultural products in the state. Or they would probably be shipping this grain by truck from Delta to Valdez. So I think it's very obvious that the conclusion has already been drawn that the rail is the most expeditious way to get this product to Tidewater. Once you have it loaded, I doubt very seriously, and you'll have to ask the railroad on this, whether there is a $2 per ton net differential between hauling the grain onto Seward versus Anchorage. Power usage. That was a question addressed for Port of Anchorage. The power usage in this sort of thing, at least from our studies, will be insignificant. Inasmuch as we already have a history in Seward of what it takes to load chips with the existing blower system, which is contemplated being used to load grain, this is an expense that wouldn't have to be added on to the price tag of this particular facility. So, and again, the cost of power then would be inconsequential. Number five, Anchorage has a greater possibility of serving as a distribution point for the agriculture industry in South Central. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not talking about an intrastate agricultural thing. We're talking about an export product. That is sheer, at this point in time, for agricultural products in Alaska, is not even a valid point to be raised here as a point of contention in weighting this kind of an equation. Number six, a complete port management system is in place. I would have to say that likewise, a complete port management system is in place in Seward in conjunction with the Alaska Railroad. And so those particular points would tend to wash themselves out. Now the points against Anchorage, number one, that is true. There is an icing and there is a tidal problem. Number two, the location of the grain terminal might cause problems with the great amount of people and dust, et cetera, et cetera. Number three, depending on site location, construction costs in Anchorage would exceed those in Seward. That is very likely true also. So all of the points, one through four, are very definitely, I feel, valid in that particular case. With the additional of one additional thing, land costs, I think we would all have to recognize, are much lower in Seward. Lease costs are much lower in Seward. And that's probably as it should be.
Mr. Campbell, may I interrupt here just a moment? Can you tell me if there's what the differences in your estimation might be from the normal lanes of shipping distances that would be incurred going, differences in distances going between Seward and going between Anchorage? Would that be of any large proportion? By ship, that is, not by land.
Well, it would depend which great circle route you were traveling between which ports. On probably the export ports are in the Far East. There would be some, yes, but the cost, the demurrage costs of having vessels wait on the tides, having vessels wait on the icing conditions. I'll cite you an example: the coal shipment that went out of Anchorage recently. The demurrage cost on that vessel laying 11 days in Homer was $20,000 a day. Now, from a pure economic standpoint, that tends to make very expensive coal in somebody's equation, in somebody's marketing situation. That is just a recent example. So distance would have some factor, yes. But the ice-free ports, the lack of vicious tides, also has a weighting factor. I'm not an economist, so I couldn't give you a hard figure over that. I would like to also, I think, reiterate here, is that most of the vessels that will be chartered for this kind of export will be probably on the open world market to get the best price of shipping. And we're recognizing that the ships that now are traveling inland, at least in wintertime, in most cases, are what they call ice-hardened. They're built strongly to use that particular stretch of water. And the ships, as a general rule of thumb, are not stressed for year-round transportation up and down the inlet. Those are the major points that I would like to make quickly without...
Madam Chairman, if I could...
Mr. Campbell,
is it
City of Seward's position that they feel the decision has already been reached?
Well, the memo states that they will recommend to the full Alaska Agricultural Council that the Port of Anchorage be picked, in, even if it should cost up to $2 million extra to put it there. The City of Seward's contention is that why put the city through the exercise of calling them to this sort of a meeting and stretching the resources of a very small community strictly for appearances' sake? And this may be for political appearances' sake, and that we would have to take umbrage to.
Mr. Campbell, I think it's noteworthy here that the fiscal note did not reflect a $2 million increase in price. So there's going to be still a problem on this in finance committee. I did want your testimony, though, since it was going to be available to transmit with our bill to finance to make sure that the feelings were known and that this study, the knowledge of the study was and recommendation was out. And I truly appreciate your coming in to give us that testimony, and we want to assure you we'll take it from the tape and make sure that the synopsis of it and as verbatim as possible will accompany the bill as it goes on to finance committee.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Are there questions from members of this group? Do I have a motion concerning SSSB 162?
I move we report the bill with individual recommendations.
Isn't there an amendment?
We have two.
Yes, we have two amendments. Excuse me. Yes. On page one, lines 6 through 8.
Changing the title of the bill to match that of the House committee.
It was a title.
Move for adoption of the two amendments.
Is there objection? Then would you like to change your...
As amended.
Is there objection?
Madam Chair, no. No objection on that, but I do want you to know I'm going to be a no rec for one reason. We get another crack at this at finance, which is perhaps a little unfair. My concern is that in my reading, and I don't pretend to be an attorney, I do not see the authority of the Action Council to actually make loans, and I think that's a legal issue that needs to be resolved. And
I'm sure you'll have a good crack at it.
Yeah, well, no, that's the reason, but, if the money passes through and then there's a problem later on, it's going to hold up your project, so that needs to be resolved, so I'll be a no.
I appreciate that, too. Any other discussion on that?
On that point, Madam Chairman, I think that's what Representative Moss was trying to tell us. And that's why he was recommending it be put in the Department of Commerce, as opposed to, to try to solve some of those.
Madam Chairman, or through the chair to Senator Gilman, one of my favorite things that I brought up, of course, is identification of subsidy. And if in fact it goes through some kind of an other loan program or lease purchase, it may be that'll kind of change the format of the bill. I don't know, but I think that's has to be looked at somewhere, and so.
Very well, then we will pass this on through as amended into Jimmy will take care of that.
Fine.
Just in time to sign it, sir.
Whatever it is.
Let's see.
A lot of faith in you.
Good. Let the record show that we have had more than a quorum in and out as day goes by. And
This is the day.
I know that you're very warm back there, so there are windows that can be open, shades that can be raised to give you some air. We have with us today the Department of Fish and Game, Commissioner Skoog. I really appreciate your coming in to brief us on, as the Resource Committee, we are very interested in knowing where we are in the various areas, resource areas within the state, where we need to be, what the first steps are to correct any problems we might have. So we are very happy to have you here today to enlighten the committee as to activities in Fish and Game. In your own, sir.
Is there any way you'd like to proceed on this one?
I was just going to ask you, would you rather give your presentation, have questions, or would you rather have questions as you go It's entirely up to you.
Whether we go, I think it's more pertinent.
As you go, committee note.
What our intent was to give just a general overview of the department and all the various divisions briefly. We can answer any questions you want, as much of the staff here. Shall I go ahead?
Yes, sir.
Briefly, the mission statement of the department and the goal is to develop and organize as technical, human, and fiscal assets to maintain, rehabilitate, and enhance the fish and wildlife resources of the state and to provide for their sustained optimum use consistent with the social, cultural, aesthetic, environmental, and economic needs of the public. Basically, this boils down to three major areas that the department functions in and carrying out its responsibility to fish and wildlife. One is maintenance, which is simply the responsibility for trying to maintain all of our fish and wildlife resources, at least in their present state, and prevent their deterioration. The second part of that, a major portion of the department's program, is simply the management of these resources, which is basically concerned with them with the management of people and the allocation of these resources among the various user groups. And the third major category in our program is enhancement, which deals with both the rehabilitation of depressed stocks of fish and wildlife that may occur, as well as the enhancement of existing stocks. Our hatchery program falls in this category. I think the value of fish and wildlife resources in the state of Alaska is probably quite evident to all of you. I think the various user groups we have, commercial, recreational, non-consumptive, and subsistence users in this state, probably makes fish and wildlife resources more important to the citizens of this state than any other state in the union. It also is a very important source through time of recurring revenue to the state. Eventually, our oil resources are going to disappear. If we treat our fish and wildlife resources properly, we'll have these items on item, and they will continue to be a major factor, or could be in the economic base of the state. Our organization is basically laid out here on this chart that's back of Senator Fisher there. Personnel, we have 700 present time, approximately 700 permanent positions in the department. We have 780 seasonal positions and 95 part-time positions. Our budget for fiscal 81 was $48 million, and our proposed budget for 82 is $58 million. Also, you have a chart indicating where all the offices are. You also have a chart, an organizational chart, I think, is your handout. But this basically is where our offices are distributed within the state, the orange being the regional offices and the green being the area offices. Also on this map, you have the small red dots indicate where the prison hatcheries are located. The yellow dots are places that have been approved for hatcheries but are in various stages of development. I'd like to point out quickly what the differences and relationships of the department are to the boards and Department of Public Safety and Entry Commission. I think many people in the state just sort of combine all of those together. The department is concerned with the management of the resources and taking the inventories necessary, getting all the information that the boards of fisheries and the game need to promulgate the regulations that allocate these resources among the various beneficial users. The boards are separate from the department. We have a lot of relations with them, however, of course, and provide them with the information they need. But the regulatory process is a separate entity in itself. Department of Public Safety is is the organization that carries out the enforcement of fish and game regulations throughout the state. We do not have an enforcement arm within the department. However, we work in close cooperation with the Department of Public Safety, and I have initiated a deputization program. It's been existing for quite a time, but I'm making it mandatory for all our field personnel to go through enforcement training at the police academy in Sitka in order to help where we can the enforcement throughout the state. Department of Public Safety, Division of Fish and Wildlife Protection has been quite understaffed throughout the year, still is, cannot possibly cover all the problems that exist in attempting to enforce fish and game regulations. Our personnel are getting trained and being deputized to aid in this effort. The Entry Commission, of course, is an autonomous body itself, quasi-judicial body, which determines the limit entry system that the legislature enacted with regard to our fisheries. Our major areas of concern in the department at present time, one is subsistence, and I think that will be perhaps a major issue in the legislature too this year.
Yeah.
And expanding demands by the public for utilizing fish and wildlife resources for whatever reason, whether it's just to watch them or to use them in a commercial manner. The developing fisheries are causing quite a bit of strain on our resources, the herring industry and the bottom fish industry. Keep lagging behind as far as our information base is concerned, but these are real problems to us now and will continue to be. The D2 implementation is going to be another serious problem to us, as well as DNR and other agencies in the department. We have many mandates given to us under the federal law, which we will have to carry out within certain time frames. I think that given the change in the federal administration, the Reagan administration, and the austerity program that they're embarked upon, gives us the opportunity, I think, to get a jump on the federal agency, because many of them will simply not be able to carry out the requirements under the D2 legislation, because they're going to need more money and more people. And they're relying, and they've been coming to us already, hoping that we'll fill the gap for them during this period of low monies and low personnel. I think that's desirable, because by getting in there first, let's say, we do have the opportunity to take a lead, perhaps, in the management of fish and wildlife on all these federal lands and the development of management systems and the land use patterns that exist.
Madam Chairman, excuse me, Commissioner hit on a nerve there when he began to talk about D2 legislation and possibly filling the gap. Does that mean that we might also have a little lever in regulation drafting and so on?
I think we'll have a considerable opportunity to work closely with the federal agencies as they develop the regulations.
I mean, we're not going to go out and fill the gap if it's some set of regulations and someone that we're going to be working with state has problems with our.
No, I don't mean that's what, but they will still have the responsibility for the regulation on their land and their program. We will always be an advisor in that sense. So where we'll be able to fill the gap in, hopefully, will be as they develop the management plans and the responsibilities that they say delegate to the state. That will be the opportunity we will have to establish a precedent and competence in certain areas of the management field that they won't be able to afford to. But the regulations will also have a hand in developing the regulations with them, because they are going to develop one way or another. Like Park Service, for example, and Fish and Wildlife Service both have come out with interim regulations. We have had a considerable exchange with them on those regulations. These are only interim regulations, and in time they're going to come out with more explicit ones, and we'll be able to be there and to help them do this, hopefully in a manner that will be beneficial to the state and to Alaska. Conversely, if the federal agencies had all the money and personnel they needed, you know, they wouldn't even ask for our support, probably, or very minimally. They're not buying now, and I think it's good to take this opportunity to move ahead of it.
Commissioner, are those interim regs, you know, interim regs have a habit of somehow gathering, becoming a little permanent as we go along, and particularly with the free zone regs. I haven't had a chance to review those regulations. How do theirs correspond or correlate with state fish and game regulations? And are they those that we can live with, or do they, are they going to cause us problems within the state?
Well, we have problems with them, but they basically have not changed much from the temporary regulations they brought forth earlier when the monuments were established.
That's what I mean, they have a chance.
They're basically the same as that. They haven't expanded upon them too much as yet, and eventually they'll remain in place until they're changed. They're permanent to that point. So the intent, of course, is to come along and change them. I think we can get the changes that we need, at least as best we can, that will help Alaska better.
I thought they didn't go into effect till 1st of March, or 15th of March.
They come into effect immediately. They're simply final reg published. They're not even proposed, they don't even have comments. Is that, am I right on that?
Was there any public hearing on at all?
Madam Chairman, is this appropriate for general comment, or Commissioner, you have some other?
We have some other things we're going to. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to?
Well, I guess that somewhere along the line, I've got a couple of basic questions I'd like perhaps a little attention on. One is in the area of conflict resolution. In other words, we might be talking about permits for oil and gas permitting. We might be talking about hydroelectric projects, I suppose coastal zone, a number of other things. And so I'd like to get a feeling of how your department works with other state agencies to work on those things that cut across departmental lines. Is to, you know, who wins, who's top dog, whose resource, one of the divisions of DNR, or does something do, you know, how do they relate to your role? The other one is that for a non-fish person, or at least I come from a non-fish area until we got into the Cook Inlet subsistence, I thought it was non-fish. I sure get an awful lot of requests and concern from people on the issue of limited entry and just the processing, going from temporary to permanent, just, you know, concerns over people, whether, you know, I realize that's the regulatory function, but that's another area that just seems like we, as we add more areas, it's becoming far more complex. And is there ever a way to make that simple, or is it just going to continue to be something that just tears a whole lot of people apart? I guess those are two areas.
We can hit both of those. The latter one, Collinsworth can handle when he makes his presentation. The other one, Bill can handle it. It concerns habitat protection, basically. Are involved in oil and gas leasing and also on and on. Is that all right to delay it till? Another major area of concern that we have had is simply that of public communications. We have been criticized over the years rather severely for not relating enough with the public. And I think part of the reason for this is simply because Fish and Wildlife Resources are so much a part of the lives of most Alaskans in one form or another that there's automatically an intense interest in what's happening with Fish and Wildlife. And, I think we've improved considerably in our communication effort, and I think largely criticisms of this sort arise because there's a lack of knowledge as to what we're doing and why we're doing it. We have been attempting to do more along this line to to get out more information on that. We have a very limited public communication staff, however, but every one of our people in the field has been urged to do as much work with the public as possible and to inform people in the reports of our actions. We do have the magazine back in circulation now. It is out for a while. We didn't have funding for it. It's a very popular periodical, and our thrust on the magazine is to present the issue a different problem or a major concern that happens in Alaska. The first issue recently was on the forest practices in southeastern. It contained a number of articles by both federal agencies and state agencies. Our next one will be on the land use problem involving the D2 situation and the whole land.
Mr. Commissioner, on your public hearing situation, it was my understanding that you had as many or more public hearings than any other agency in the state. Am I incorrect about that?
Well, I'm sure we do. As far as the regulatory process that we go through discussing regulations and our various programs, we have to be more democratic than any other state in the union. Board of Fisheries goes through quite a lengthy process of listening to testimony day after day. Some states, you know, the commissioner of Fish and Game, he simply signs off regulations. There's no public hearings at all. In other states, the legislature sets them. Again, in this state, we have an extensive hearing. We hardly make a move without public hearings, and throughout the state, as far as that goes. I think this too has, you know, part of this that has been an aid has been the establishment of the local advisory committee system. We have, I think it's 66 advisory committees throughout the state. And the chairman of each one of these advisory committees is in attendance when the board meets the promulgated regulations. I think just the knowledge that the public generally, I think, has reached that they at least do have the opportunity to present their views throughout the year on just about anything that happens in Fish and Game has done an awful lot, I think, to better our relations with the public. I think that advisory committee system might benefit from a little more elaboration if it's agreeable to the committee. And Greg Cook is here, he's executive director for the board. He could expound on that order.
Great. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Resources Committee. As Dr. Scooter said, I work for the Board of Fisheries and for the Board of Game. And as he mentioned in his address to you, those entities are somewhat separate from the Department of Fish and Game, although we do work together very closely. Both of the boards, very briefly, are involved in setting regulations. That's their primary goal. And in doing this, they rely to a great extent upon the network of advisory committees that Dr. Skoog has described. There are at present time 66 of these local fish and game advisory committees throughout the state of Alaska. Any local group, any local community rather, can petition the boards for creation of an advisory committee. In fact, at the last joint meeting of the boards, six new advisory committees were created. So I think that shows several things. One, it shows the board's commitment to receiving public testimony and benefiting from what the public has to say, always in an advisory capacity. The board members certainly recognize that the decision rests on their shoulders, but they're always willing to listen to whatever it is that the public has to say. And also, the second thing I think it shows is that the public in general is supportive of the advisory committee system. Otherwise, they would not be as active as they are or eager to participate in new advisory committees. The advisory committees that we have now are organized fairly loosely and have been since March of 1979 in a system of regional councils. Those of you who have read Title 8 of the D2 bill that was recently enacted already know that regional councils are included in federal law, but we've had these in state law for a little, well, close to 2 years now. The state system of regional councils is based upon the advisory committee system, and based on what the advisory committee members themselves said, is designed to enhance the local participation rather than to replace it with another bureaucratic patina. The advisory committees now play a larger role in the deliberations of both boards, both the Board of Game and the Board of Fisheries, than ever before. In fact, even after the regular oral public hearing is closed, the advisory committee members for that area are allowed to participate directly in the deliberations of the board, so that if you are to accept the premise of an advisory group acting in that capacity, then I think it would be very difficult to create a larger role for them than that which they play now. I think the boards have shown very good faith, really, in the last, at least since I've been involved with the board since 1978, in trying to cultivate the advisory committees and see that system mature and work even better. There are two main issues, I think, that would benefit from being addressed by the legislature this year in regard to advisory committees and making them work better. Number one is, I think that at the present time, a large number of advisory committee members, especially those who live in the rural areas of the state, are essentially subsidizing the system themselves, in that they have to we pay for their travel, we through you, the state as a whole, pays for their travel to local meetings of the advisory committee, but oftentimes because of weather or simply any other logistics, they have to spend the night in that community, but there are no funds to reimburse them on whatever level. They may not be staying at the Killigannick Hilton, they may be staying at a relative's home, but the fact of the matter is that it costs them something out of pocket to bring a housewarming present or some kind of thing where they can not be a burden on the person with whom they're staying. So I think some level of local per diem payments would be in order and would be fair to the local advisory committees. At the present time, the system only includes payment of per diem expenses when the one delegate attends the statewide meetings of the board, and we've had well over half of the advisory committees in the state participate and spend time at those board meetings, and that level is increasing now. The other aspect of the advisory committee system that I think would really benefit from your attention is something that's contained in the D2 budget request, and this is the creation of some regional personnel to work directly with the advisory committees. In certain areas of the state, let's take Game Unit 23, for example, up where Senator Ferguson lives. We have advisory committees up in the Kobuk and No-Attack drainages and out on the Seward Peninsula that are quite remote. Oftentimes, meetings are very difficult to arrange, and it's more of a burden on the local biologist to arrange these than is really possible. Local specialists to help the advisory committees could assist their logistics, could improve the information available to them, could help ensure that the requirements of the federal legislation we have to deal with now are met, and help ensure that state prerogatives for managing fisheries and wildlife are retained. So very briefly, those are two items that I think could benefit from your attention. I'd also like to mention two specific topics for each board, the Board of Game and Board of Fisheries, that I think are very high in their interests. I spoke with Dr. Sam Harbo of the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, who is the chairman of the Alaska Board of Game, yesterday, and Dr. Harbo asked me to mention these two specific topics to you. The first one is the issue of clear-cut logging in southeastern Alaska and the effects that that has on wildlife resources. Dr. Harbo viewed a portion of the Capital 81 program on television, in which a briefing was given to the Resources Committee, and asked me to request the Resources Committee to receive further information regarding the effect of clear cutting on our wildlife populations here in southeastern. The Board of Game and the Board of Fisheries also are very concerned about some of these practices and want to maintain these renewable resources. This fits in very nicely to Senator Strzelczewski's question. The other topic that Dr. Harbo asked me to bring to your attention is the bison range in the area of Delta. And Dr. Harbo is strongly supportive of development of the bison range and planting of barley for the benefit of the bison. It would be a shame to lose this resource in
Madam Chair, also a training program to tell them where to go.
I was just going to say, which side of the road were you going to plant them on, or which side of the creek? But
up the river and in the field.
I discussed that with the two local biologists this morning, to tell you the truth there, Senators. And they feel that with a fairly minimal investment of about $50,000 of planting that for summer feed, that the animals could be kept on the right side of the river. Fisheries items where my expertise is no greater. I think if there were any two fisheries topics that the Board of Fisheries would want to emphasize, they would be these. First of all, it's the need for improved data from the Department of Fish and Game. And this means adequate efforts and adequate funds devoted to research capabilities in order to determine the extent of the resource and also the extent of human pressures on that resource. At the same time, I would not want to minimize the interactive effects of other kinds of resource development. I assume that Dr. Logan will speak to that from the habitat protection section. The second aspect that I think would be very high on priorities from the Board of Fisheries would be enforcement. As you know, it makes no sense to pass laws or regulations unless the state has the ability to see that those regulations are indeed followed. You've probably already heard quite a bit of testimony about the level of enforcement activities that the Division of Fish and Wildlife Protection through the Department of Public Safety is able to mount. It's the Board of Fisheries' opinion that more and better enforcement definitely is needed in order to have the management programs of the board carried out and ensure that their policies are followed through on.
May I interrupt you just a second? I'm a little confused now. I thought I understood the commissioner say that you were taking training at the police academy and that you're working with public safety. Is that correct?
Yeah, we are.
Okay. And you're saying you don't have enough enforcement people?
No, it does.
Madam Chairman,
protection of the Department of Public Safety. We're not professional enforcement agents, and just taking some training in the police academy doesn't make us professional, but allows us that our people, when they're in the field and they encounter a violation, at least they know how to go about making a citation and collecting whatever evidence they need and giving that to the local protection officer, and he carries it through the courts.
But does this give Fish and Game personnel the authority to arrest a man for speeding or ticket him for speeding?
Well, let's see. If they're deputized, I guess if they're deputized, they're deputized that they can carry out the laws of the state. But don't we have laws of the state? All right. So they are. They could. But
well, I guess what I'm getting, I'm baiting
you.
I now admit I'm baiting you because I got arrested by Fish and Game for speeding.
That's public safety, though.
Sure, okay. That doesn't make me want to be too lenient towards we don't have enough enforcement.
I understand, Jeff, a proposed enforcement business. Or not just understand, I've been told by quite a few people out of Bristol Bay about the problem of lack of enforcement of commercial fisheries out there with respect to permits and gear and everything else. And has this been a problem of the department making, or public safety, whoever, making requests to legislature and being turned down, or have there not been adequate requests?
That's basically been it. They have not really gotten their requests attended to. And it's not a cheap operation. It takes a fair amount of equipment. It takes a lot of people. It's a big state to cover. Bristol Bay has been a problem, but they intend this year in that Bristol Bay fishery to have a greatly increased enforcement presence there. They're simply going to take people from other areas of the state and move them into there.
You alluded to the fact that the biologist, I assume they're biologists going to the police academy to learn how to apprehend the bandits. Could you supply us with information how many of these biologists have actually made an arrest?
It varies, of course, with different areas. We can supply that. Just because they go through the training, you know, a lot of people just aren't attuned to enforcement because it requires a confrontation. And a lot of people avoid that kind of activity, you know, as much as they can. And even though they have they're deputized and have a badge, certain more people can go near it.
Well, that brings up another point. I think, you know, we've heard a lot of comments that there's a real reluctancy on the part of biologists to become involved in that field. And I, you know, at least my position is they're working for the state, and management is important not only biologically but enforcement. And I think, you know, if there is a reluctance on the part of these people, maybe they ought to send them back to school.
Well, I share your views, and that's why I've made it mandatory. We're changing all our position descriptions. That one of the responsibilities identified in the position description is law enforcement. However, you're still not going to force someone to make a case if he's reluctant to do so. You can easily look the other way, you know. And we have, there are some are involved that really leap into it, you know, to the detriment of their biological work, really. They just go into the law enforcement and spend more time with that than doing other work. But we have to recognize that public safety's primary responsibility is enforcement. They don't get involved much in collecting biological data reports, for example, and conversely, ours is the other of biological data, so we don't get involved full time in enforcement.
Madam Chairman, of course, to carry this one step further, I would suggest maybe then that those who do not want to become involved, maybe we find somebody who would be involved. If it is really a problem, I think it is.
Well, like I say, it's in some areas. Like, we don't want to lose a good biologist in an area. Let's say he knows an awful lot about crab in an area. And we don't want to pull him out and put someone who is going to do enforcement work in there. We don't get the information we need on crab.
I can't believe
a trade-off there.
Well, I can't believe that somebody is really interested in biology who really want to make the system work, but you can't show any concern for enforcement. You know, it just doesn't seem.
Well, what we're trying to do is to make them knowledgeable about how to enforcement activities so that they're capable of gathering the information that is needed. If they view a violation, they can at least gather the information and then report it to a protection officer who can carry it through with the citation and that's a considerable help in itself because many fish and wildlife violations, you almost need to be on the scene in order to get a conviction. So we need all the witnesses, you might say, that we can have. Our biologists are scattered all through the state. I expect them not to avoid a violation if they come across. But you're still going to have people that are timid about enforcement. No matter what you do to them, they don't want anything to do with it. Because it's a fear thing, really. They don't want to have to confront someone because immediately they go, well, what if he resists me? You know, what do I do then? And what I don't want our people doing is to go beyond the bounds of legality either. Because it's easy to get in trouble with law enforcement if you overstep your legal prerogative. And only a professional law enforcement really knows fully what those are. Well, I'd like to continue on, and Deputy. Oh, you got something else?
Okay, very briefly then, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I have already distributed several sets of documents to the members of the committee pertaining to both Southeastern Fisheries and to Cook Inlet Fisheries. One of the major topics that the Board of Fisheries will have to deal with very soon is Cook Inlet and subsistence fishing. There will be a special hearing and meeting in Anchorage on March 20 through 22. This is noted on the packet I've distributed to you. If you have comments to make regarding Cook Inlet subsistence fishing, I would certainly appreciate having the opportunity to talk with you at some other time or to receive your comments and to pass them on to the board and extend this invitation to you to attend that meeting of the board. Finally, we have a publication that we put out, the advisory committee newsletter. Those of you who've been in the legislature for a few years have seen it already. The other members of the committee will be seeing it very shortly, and this is one of the items that we use to augment the department's public communications ability. With that, I'll sum up. I can tell Dr. Scoo wants to move on and see if there's any further questions.
I have one question. You're with Commerce, right?
No, ma'am. I'm with the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game and the Department of Fish and Game.
Okay, I'll hold it then, because I'm going to find somebody else to get this.
Madam Chairman, I have one question for Drake. How do you select the members of the advisory committees now? What method are you using?
Madam Chairman, Senator Eliason, the regulations currently in effect specify that members of local fish and game advisory committees are elected by the members of the public who live in that locality and attend the meeting of the advisory committee. So the advisory committee is not self-perpetuating. They are popularly elected within that area.
Thank you. Any other questions? Commissioner Scoop?
On my left is Don Collinsworth. He's Deputy Commissioner of Resource Management. And on your organizational chart, you'll see he has a division of game, sport fisheries, commercial fisheries, the Fred division, and the board. He'll give a brief one.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to provide you quickly a brief thumbnail sketch of each of the resources divisions, and I'm going to throw out a bunch of numbers and things at you, but the purpose of doing that is to give you some idea about the size of the BRU, what they do and what their budgets are and things like that. So I'll proceed rather rapidly. I'll start with the Sport Fish Division, and Rupert Andrews is the director of that division. Rupe has responsibility for the management of the statewide sport fishery. Rupe has 65 permanent full-time people and 78 seasonal, for a peak of 143 people at the peak season to manage the state's sport fisheries. His FY81 operating budget is $4.3 million, and he had 252 CIP and FY81 for non-specific access purchases. His FY2 request is $5.48 million and a CIP of $500,000. In 1980, calendar year 1980, there were 206,000 sport fish licenses sold in the state. And if you include those fishermen who are under 16 years old and over 60 years old, that adds another 36,000 for a total. Yeah, 206,000 sport fish licenses sold. And then if you add in the anglers under 16 and the anglers over 60, they account for another 36,000 for a total of 242,000 recreational anglers. Sport fishermen caught 3.1 million fish in 1980, and 360,000 of that catch were salmon. 65% of all angling effort was on the Kenai Peninsula. The estimated total value of recreational fisheries in the state is about $115 million.
Excuse me. In those figures, you say about so many of them are salmon, and this is sports fisheries. Now that doesn't take in grayling or those type of fishing.
No.
Okay.
The 3.1 million would take in the other species. The 360,000 were salmon. And Rupe.
How do you get that figure? Is there a report from the sports fishermen?
These are estimates for creel salmon, but Rupert might want to elaborate.
Yes, Madam Chairman, each year for the last 3 years, this is our fourth year, we've conducted a statewide mail questionnaire. Our statewide estimates by species and by localities, and even by specific waters, are from this questionnaire. We built in 15 checkpoints into the questionnaire when we do intensive creel census. We compare the questionnaire results with our creel census results, and we feel that we have a very accurate estimate statewide.
Mm-hmm. I've never gotten one.
How do you arrive at 165 million?
Yeah.
115 million?
115 million.
Rupert?
That's a good question. That's one of the softest spots that we have. But where we get that is back in 1973, we did let a contract with Boeing Computer Services, who did a statewide economic survey. Since that time, that was based on 1973 fish rate. Since that time, we've extrapolated. We won't even go beyond 115 anymore because it's just too soft a figure. We think that's a conservative figure statewide. One of our proposals now is to do an economic survey.
What is it composed of?
What is it composed of?
About 39,000 sport caught halibut a year in the state, of which about 37,000 come out of Kachemak Bay.
Gosh, I want to go to Kachemak Bay.
You can come get some clams, and they've never caught me, but I can pick them up.
I think we ought to
put a gate in mile 38.
I think we ought to reclassify halibut.
With your permission, Madam Chairman, I'll proceed.
We'll behave, honestly.
In 1980, calendar year license sales for a sport fish license totaled about $2.5 million. Principal area concern for the sport fish division, principal focus of their program will be in 1980, this fiscal year, and 82 will be directed toward Cook Inlet and Kenai Peninsula. They'll be engaging in extensive creel census work, angling use patterns, stock assessment, monitoring public access, and also they have a major project, an installation of a $300,000 Kenai River king salmon trap. This trap is going to be placed below the Kenai River Bridge and is intended to provide stock strength and indexing information, timing, etc., which for the king salmon returns, which has heretofore been unavailable in a timely fashion to be used for in-season management. Going on to commercial.
Madam Chairman, could we have one question on that, Don?
Sure.
The sports division has jurisdiction over certain streams for broodstock?
In what regard? I mean,
in what regard?
Are you talking about the Fred division, the broodstock program? Well, the broodstock management is primarily management up into the terminal areas, which is commercial fisheries division.
I'm talking about sports streams that would have king salmon now. Who would have jurisdiction whether or not Fred Division could get broodstock from these streams?
Well, usually we try to take them through the commercial fisheries. We manage for that additional return to a stream through the commercial fishery.
That's a coordinated department to see.
Well, you mean, we get together and we determine that what we're trying to do in this area is we're trying to manage for broodstock for hatchery in southeastern. You know, we identify the areas that we would like to take our broodstock, make some assessment of what the escapement requirements are, and then we try to manage all of the intercepting fisheries to that point to get our minimum escapement. And then once we have our minimum escapement goals, and then we manage for broodstock too.
I don't want to belabor it very farther, much further, but once you reach the escapement and there's no other fish available for broodstock, then when there's fish are in the stream, who has to sign off for the Fed Division to pick up these fish for broodstock?
You mean if we have our minimum escapements?
Right.
Then the fish and egg transport forms that we require to take those fish, I sign.
Sports Division does not have an effective role in that decision.
In doing that, Sports Fish and Comfish and the Fred Division all take a look at the take and advise me as to how it should be done.
I have a question here. When sports fishermen are doing their research, or the sports department and the commercial department's research, is there close coordination on that? I guess I'm baiting again. I might as well explain what I'm trying to say. From some of the, you know, you can hear anything, and some of the questions and stories and requests that we have, it's been pictured as commercial research people and sports research people practically bumping into each other in the same areas doing research at the same time on the same thing in different areas or something.
Well, as I pointed out, the Sport Fish Division has 60 permanent full-time people statewide, so it's hard to bump into them. They don't have that many people. But to answer your question more specifically, we develop each year fisheries cover program. All three of the fishery divisions, Fred Division, Sport Fish, and Comfish, come together under one cover program. And for example, last year, we went through each of the division's budgets, proposals, and project by project, region by region, and species by species. We put them all up on the board for Southeastern, for example. Every project that each of the three divisions were engaged in was put on the board and discussed in terms of whether it was an activity that needed cross-divisional cooperation or interaction, and whether it included, you know, just the activities of one division. There are several things that each of the three fisheries divisions do that are pretty much in their own domain. A number of other things, of course, are interdivisional in the impact. And we're trying to ensure a greater and greater degree of coordination between those projects which are interdivisional. A lot of the perhaps adverse comments about the divisions not being coordinated is more conventional wisdom than fact, because I think we do have a good degree of coordination of the activities of the divisions, and it's improving.
Could it be that sometimes the coordination is all at the same place at the same time?
Well, I'm not sure.
Everything slips once.
You heard about the slip.
But the activities of the divisions are somewhat separated. The commercial fisheries are primarily a marine orientation, and the sport fisheries is primarily a freshwater orientation. But certainly in the estuarian areas and working with certain stocks, there is coordination. The sport fish, for example, coordinate tags Taku River salmon, and Comfish collects the tags from the processor, and so that program necessarily has to be coordinated, and it is.
Thank you.
All right, I'll go on then to commercial fisheries, and Steve Fenoyer is the director. In FY81, Steve had 174 permanent full-time employees and 436 seasonals, and 44 temporaries, for a total of peak season employment of 654 people. This is during the peak of the summer season, primarily oriented to salmon, and where we have the counting towers and operate counting towers and weirs and stations collecting tags on it. His FY81 operating budget is $12.9 million and a CIP of $1.3 million. The FY82 request is $15.6 million and a CIP of $1.5 million. In 1980, they had a direct employment in the fisheries of some 43,700, and that's made up of 19,486 commercial fishermen and 24,228 crewmen. Direct employment then of almost 44,000 people. Another 10,000 workers were employed in approximately 200 processing plants. And of course, there were several thousand more in secondary and affiliated industries that support the fishing industry. The ex vessel value in 1980 was approximately $550 million, and with a first wholesale value of well over $1 billion. The estimated revenue for FY82 is approximately $20 million from taxes and licenses. Areas of concern that Steve's going to be concentrating on the rest of this year and next year is, that, of course, a kind of a basic maintenance of brood stock and allocation. That's kind of the principal focus of that program. But also southeastern Alaska troll salmon fishery, U.S., Canada, and the Oregon and Washington, southeastern transfer of fish back and forth through primarily of King and Coho, Prince William Sound, Kodiak Peninsula, and Bering Sea herring, Kodiak and Peninsula shrimp, Cook Inlet user allocation of stock surplus, high sea salmon interception destined for Western Alaska. You've probably heard recently of the concern in that regard of some 700,000 teams, many of which may be of Western Alaska origin that have been intercepted in the Japanese gillnet fishery. Also, he'd be focusing on the management allocation, the upriver and downriver management problems of the Yukon, also Norton Sound king crab, and then a mixed salmon species management in southeastern Alaska.
I wonder if you want to talk about limited entry
first, would you go back and you said X value?
Well, the X vessel value was $550 million.
Okay, and then what was?
And then the first wholesale value is well over $1 billion. You could, just as a rule of thumb, from X vessel to first wholesale is a factor of two is generally low.
Would you explain what is X vessel?
What I'm looking for is the same figure we have for sports fish. What is the financial impact statewide on fisheries? Do you have that figure?
I don't have that figure, Senator. And Department of Commerce does develop some index multipliers for that. And it could be, I would suppose, between 3 and 4, the X vessel value.
Which is around $2 billion.
$2 billion or more, yeah.
Plus the $1.1 billion. The product.
Well, but that would be the ultimate value as you start going through the multiplying it through the economy, through the various sectors of the economy, until it ends up in a final retail product.
The X vessel price is the price off the vessel.
That's the price to the fisherman. X vessel is the fisherman comes up the processor and he gets paid a dollar a pound. That's it.
You wish.
For something.
I'd like it.
Madam Chairman, again, the entry commission was moved to the Department of Fish and Game by executive order for administrative purposes, and we process administratively some of their personnel.
We need to talk to them to get my concerns answered. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. And
that's a good thought.
Well, I mean, that's what we think.
Yeah. I don't know if I could answer your question. If you want to pose it specifically, I might. But if it just has to do with the issuance of permits and things like that.
Well, why things aren't you know, why they're not being able to move from temporary to permanent, what's happening in the process, and kind of what the overview is. I'd like to know, if we've got so many problems right now, what are we going to have in 5 years with limited entry, I guess? And so it's more of a philosophical thing. Where is that whole process of management going? And perhaps
Commissioner Bob Simon would probably be the best
so,
information.
But I'm very interested, and I'm going to leave it three, have to leave it three, on that conflict resolution, because that's another one we hear again. We just had your suggestion that we bring certain people and ask certain questions. Well, who's in charge? Between departments, if you will, on some of those issues. I'm really interested in that. Madam Chair, I think that Senator
Lassen. Madam Chairman, I just want to get back. I want to make a point here. You said there was 41,000 fishermen, right?
There's 20,000 commercial fishermen, 24,000 crew members, okay, for a total of 43,700 direct employment in the fishery.
Okay, now we're talking about excess value of the fish, mm-hmm. $500 million, so, which breaks down to about $12,000 per fisherman, which is, you know, just above the poverty level.
You're not getting rich, is your point.
No.
Shall we continue? Bill, you were going
to... Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was going to respond to the question of how do you resolve conflict and who is ultimately in charge. Mm-hmm. At the department level, if we have conflict, we attempt to work them out directly at either the program level, a deputy commissioner level, or finally the commissioner level. And if that can't be done, we do have a process where we go to the governor's office for a final resolution or a decision. And it's a formal process that we have developed, the state has developed, and that we have used in the department.
May I interject one question here? Do you feel that this recommended permitting system will help to alleviate some of those problems?
Or the recommended permit system for hand coders you're talking about?
No. No. No, not really. Yeah. All we have received from the governor's office are a one-stop shopping, if you will, theory type permit system bill, which is supposed to have been worked out by Fish and Game, DNR.
We do have a single permit that each of us use, and we have agreed to use it. And when did we finish working that out, Dave?
We're still working out, Madam Chairman. You're talking about the regulatory reform packages of the governor's office. We've dealt with that over about the last 6 months. There's some funny sidelights that have come out, and I'm sure Senator Gillen would be interested in. But the intent was to take what they felt a very complex regulatory package and get it into a more simplified approach. The idea of the simplified approach, less points of contact to go to, so that when an individual went in, he didn't have to go to 504 different spots. He could come to one spot. He ultimately would get his permit. It has a very great deal of merit. There have been some questions, several of the approaches taken in there. There has been a territorial battle as to who has authority over what. The final intent of that bill has said that the line agency with primary land authority will be the agency that controls the permitting organization. And the role you're probably most interested in is what that did to coastal zone management. All right, what this says is that now DNR and DEC will become the lead agencies in virtually all activities that occur in the state that require any kind of multiple look at permitting responsibilities. Coastal zone management was reduced. My gut reaction to it is being ineffective under this new approach. The role of the governor's office or the role of an objective third body is not in those regulations as it stands now. The power to make coastal zone decisions with consistency now rests with DNR and DEC regulations. I think that may be part of what you're
doing. Well, part of it. Now, also in oil and gas and hydro and the whole process, there's a, you know, I don't know if it fits in that there's a lead agency there, for instance, in hydrant. Yeah.
There will be a lead agency in force meter reactivity that occurs. Now, DMEM would carry, for instance, the lead agency in any oil gas. All responses would go to DMEM. I think one interesting sidelight that came out that Senator Gillman truly loved is that we have operated for years without regulation because of the more convenient way to do business. Yeah. Under regulatory reform, we were forced into the promptly in the regulation where we did not have a legal system. So that was a sidelight and permit simplification. We ended up with regulations where we didn't have.
Do you understand the permit simplification still?
Not totally.
I'm sorry, I was baiting you a little too. We have an explanation of it, but here before the committee, but the one that gave it to us didn't seem to understand it too well either, and I never did when we got through with it. But I think it, what I did get out of it, correct me if I'm wrong, Commissioner Scoob, was that everybody had worked together to try to come up with something that would work. And,
of course, the intent is to get one decision out of
right.
the state.
Mm-hmm.
And what has been the problem in the past is, for example, DNR may have come along with their permitting the decision and made one statement, let's say, a decision statement to the Corps of Engineers, for example. And then Fish and Game might have come along and made something that was derogatory or was negative, whereas DNR was positive. And then the Corps of Engineers had two statements from the state. So the intent is to give one agency the responsibility of making the final decision. Now that agency, let's say DNR, still has the responsibility of going to all the other agencies to get their comments on any given project that needs a permit. And they will receive our comments and we'll send those to them. And the question that came up with the governor was that in order to be sure that we are carrying out our responsibilities for protecting fish and wildlife habitat, then any position statement that we make would in fact be public information. Be available to anyone prepared to view it or read it, in spite of what DNR may do. They may go contrary to what our concerns are and simply give the permit where we would recommend it not being given, but at least it be public. Also, the governor made the statement that if an agency such as ourselves really had very serious, strong concerns over the issue of a permit, that question could be raised into the governor's office. And then he would take it and be the arbitrating body.
Then I can see some advantages.
Madam Chair, how will this be put in place? What you're talking about, by executive order, by a series of regulations? It's in place.
Yeah, it's submitted. It was sent. I think you were checking your supplies as we sent it to everybody here.
Well, no, but is it in the form of an executive administrative order or regulations under a statute? That's what I don't.
Madam Chair, it will be in the form of regulations. John joined me up in the governor's office drafting the regulatory reform regulations.
Okay, because I've seen the draft, and that's, we're still talking about the same thing. It'll go into.
Right. They just held public hearings last week around the state, and so they will be in the process of finalizing this. I understand we have a meeting March 6th with all the state agencies to do the final study. But relatively speaking, it's a simple idea. Those two agencies that have proprietary interests, DNR, DEC will control all the permits related to the proprietary interest. They then filter out and do all the crap that people have had to do in the past. So it's a very good system. It's just now a question of did somebody lose something in the process?
Excuse us interrupting so much. And go right ahead, Commissioner.
Madam Chairman, the Fred Division, the director of the Fred Division is Bob Royce. He has 168 employees and 40 seasonals were peak employment in the summer of 150 employees. He has a peak employment of 318 people, 150 seasonals, 168 full-time employees, and the seasonals are used primarily during the egg-taking operations and the operations of the facilities in that season. His FY81 budget was $10.5 million. His CIP budget was approximately $9 million. The request for 82 is $11.5 million, and a CIP budget of request of $3.5 million. The major program emphasis for FY 81 is the shakedown of the new hatcheries and development of broodstock at the hatcheries. Of course, you understand it's important in a cost-benefit sense to bring the hatcheries up to full egg capacity as quickly as possible. The rate at which the benefit costs cross axes and we start getting the maximum benefit from facilities is a function of how quickly we can bring it up to full utilization. Also, they intend to maintain and intensify their mark tagging program at the hatcheries and to maintain a strong pathology and genetics program. The major successes of FY 81 were the fact that we put into the hatcheries 879,000 hatchery bred salmon returned to the facilities and to the fisheries in 1980, and that the Fred Division took 168 million eggs for incubation. This is about 80 million more than we had in 1979. Now we're shooting for a 630 million egg take just as quickly as we can get there. The major thrust for the Fred Division FY82 will be the continuation of the broodstock development and continue the shakedown of the new facilities and design of and completion of the work on the facilities that are under construction, improve and intensify the evaluation, the marking, and the tagging of hatchery fish. Also to emphasize our commitment to sport fishermen through trout and salmon stocking projects, provide technical assistance and provide to the private nonprofit aquaculture associations, and to continue departmental planning with the regional planning team.
One question there. I see you have a red dot. It looks like up probably Yukon River. Is that one functioning now, the hatchery there?
Not in
interior?
Or here?
No, interior.
Madam Chairman, that would be the clear hatchery.
Clear,
yeah.
The clear hatchery.
It is. Commercial salmon fishermen of all gear types, sport fishermen and subsistence fishermen benefit from the rehab and enhancement efforts of the Thread Division. And rainbow trout, steelhead trout, grayling are produced specifically for the sportsmen. We also had an interesting phenomenon this year. The state hatchery facilities became a visitor's attraction, and we had 100,000 visitors visit the state hatcheries. Capital investment in hatcheries and fishways to date is approximately $78 million in hatcheries and $2.6 million in fishways. I'll move right along to the game division. Ron Somerville is the director. Ron has 150 permanent full-time employees. 115 permanent full-time, 15 permanent full-time employees, 33 seasonal employees for a peak employment, 148 employees. He had an FY 81 operating budget of $7.1 million and zero CIP. His FY 82 request for operating is 8.7 and 250,000 for CIP. And the CIP is for moose habitat improvement in the Napsu Valley and along Tope River.
What's last year's budget?
Last year's budget, FY 81 operating was $7.1 million. For calendar year 1980, approximately 82,000 hunting licenses were sold, 23,400 trapping licenses, and we had 7,289 non-resident hunting licenses. Hunting and trapping licenses revenue for calendar year 1980 was about $2.5 million. In terms of employment, direct employment, those the 23,400 trappers, 121 licensed fur dealers, about 1,300 guides and assistant guides. And secondary employment, including air charter operators, taxidermists, lodge owners, sporting goods dealers, is approaching an estimated 20,000. more individuals. The areas of concern and principal focus of the division program, again, is the maintenance of the wildlife population in the face of increasing human demand. And with the changing land status in Alaska, what we see is there's going to be fewer acres to access to hunt, and we will be concentrating the hunting activities in a smaller area. The demand is increasing. This is going to call for a more intensive management program if we are in fact going to provide for continuing hunting.
Excuse me, Senator Gilman?
You mentioned moose habitat. Has there been any discussions or work with the Kenai National Moose Range where they had habitat program started over years to crush it?
Madam Chairman. Yes, Senator, I'd like to ask Director Somerville to respond specifically to the question. You can do that.
Madam Chairman? Yes, Senator Gilman, we have had extensive discussions with them trying to encourage them into other areas of crushing, particularly in some coal burns. We've got work to work through. And they just don't have the money for it. They indicated some interest in continuing habitat improvement if the state was willing to fund some of that. But so far, though, we're kind of neophytes in the habitat improvement field, which we've done very little bit of ourselves. We're looking at some coal burning and interior and possibly working more with forest coal burning specific areas on the Kenai as well as the crushing, but we don't have a big budget for that.
You don't have that yet, too.
The only thing we have is this one CIP submission for $250,000 that covers three projects. Mad Valley is just a pilot project, Choke River, and part of that is for bison in the Delta. There's nothing specific identified.
Yeah. Kind of a shame, Madam Chairman, the crushers are sitting there idle and have been for 2 or 3 years. Do you have any data that shows the results of a particular size of